Now, we see all the way through the scriptures, and we've already seen this, that one of the sins that God has a special hatred for is lying. He also has, not a hatred, but he's very demanding where vows are concerned. He doesn't like somebody to make a vow not knowing if they can keep it, or to make a deceptive vow and so forth. God's feeling on the matter, it seems to be better not to vow at all and then either do it or don't do it than to give a false vow or give a vow you're not sure you can fulfill. So having said that, I just want to build the base here of what's in God's mind and God's heart, and then we'll get into chapter 34 and see what happens there. Now, we're going to be looking at just a few scriptures, and we're going to build up from these scriptures a little theological statement. Okay? Now, in Matthew chapter 5, and verses 33 to 37. Listen what the Lord says. This is the Lord teaching his disciples. Again, you have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. But I say to you, make no oath at all, by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make a vow, an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no. And basically what Yeshua is saying here is, if there's something that you feel obligated to do to or for someone, just do it. Don't make a vow, especially the day they would vow by heaven, we vow by the altar, you know. Of course, the Pharisees ran wild with it and made it all kinds of like, a puzzle that you can't work your way out of. But it seems as though Yeshua's advice to us is, just don't make vows. You can't get any trouble if you don't make a vow. If you do, it can cause you a great amount of trouble. And then in Psalm 54, and this shows you how strongly God feels about the making and the possible breaking of vows. Suppose you make a vow to someone. You've sat down, you've gone over the entire situation, and it's quite clear to you this vow is to your advantage. So you enter into this agreement with this person, and then after you enter into the agreement, the next day you sit down and you think and you say, this is really no good at all. It's too late. As far as God is concerned, you made a vow. And it says in Psalm 52, Psalm 15. In Psalm 15 and verse 4, look what it says. Now, this is a psalm of David, and he goes, O Lord, who may abide in your tent? And who may dwell on your holy hill? And then he gives a list of qualities that a person who would dwell with God should have. And notice what it says in verse 4, second half of the verse. He swears to his own hurt and does not change. And what that's saying is, if I tell you you're going to do something like that last scene I painted, and you sit down and say, this is not working to my advantage, it's working to my disadvantage, well, you're supposed to, as far as God's concerned, swear to your own hurt. The fact that I'm not going to make the profit I thought I made, or I'm not going to get the advantage I thought I had, or the promotion, or whatever it is not a valid reason for breaking a vow. Now, in our country, we have a body of law called contract law. And if I enter into a contract with you, and one of the two of us feels that the other person didn't hold up their end of the bargain, the first question is, was there in fact a vow? Was there a legal contract? That's the first thing the court will want to deal with. Because just because I enter into an agreement with you doesn't mean that that agreement meets the legal qualifications for it being enforceable in court. But now, our system of law does have certain exceptions. If I contract with you, let's say I'm a farmer, and I contract with you to sell you 1,000 bushels of wheat at $4 a bushel, then I find out I can get $6 a bushel elsewhere, I've already made a vow. And for me to come up with any reason under the sun not to live up to that vow displeases God. Now, one of the exceptions, and just to show how tight this law is, what they call impossibility. Between the time we enter into the contract and the time I'm to fulfill the contract, if something takes place to make it impossible to fill that vow, then I'm not obligated. For example, if I contract to sell you 1,000 bushels of wheat and there's a drought in the United States and all the states that produce wheat, they can't produce it, that's called impossibility. And then under those circumstances, I'm not what they call breach of contract. But in John 8:44, and we've looked at this before, John 8:44, and this will show us a little bit of insight into why the Lord feels the way he does about lying. He's speaking to the Pharisees who do not believe him. You are of your father the devil, and you want to do the desires of your father. Now watch what he says here. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth, because there is no truth in him. Now what is the relationship between him being a murderer and him being a liar? Clearly, the Lord is connecting those two things together. Now, specifically in the case of Adam, Eve, and the serpent, it's very literal relationship between deceit and murder, because in a very sly way, the serpent, who is the devil, deceived Eve. He lied to her. And he just right out lied. He didn't, sometimes you know, you build a lie that seems to be true. He didn't even bother to do that. He told her an outright lie. And the result of his telling her that lie was the human race was defiled. And God had to go a number of centuries to build his plan of redemption so that he could free the human race from death and sin. So it's understandable that God would be so much, it affects him so much, because lying, remember, is the gateway to every other sin. when a person learns at a very young age, if they do something wrong and lie about it, they can get out of it. And so lying becomes a part of every sin you do. And you become a compulsive liar. And the life of a liar is a hard life. They're trying to make it easier on themselves. But it's just like Shakespeare's web. You get tangled up in a web of deceit. Because once you tell one lie, all of a sudden you got to come up with another lie to cover that first lie. And somewhere down the road, there's going to be a contradiction. Okay? Now, watch this. Acts chapter 5. Acts chapter 5. But this is right at the beginning of the very beginning of the church. But a man named Ananias with his wife Sapphira sold a piece of property and kept back some of the price for himself with his wife's full knowledge, and bringing a portion of it, he laid it at the apostles' feet. But Peter said to Ananias, "Why has Satan filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit and keep back some of the piece of land?" Now, he wasn't upset, and we'll read this as we go further. Peter wasn't upset with the fact that he held back some of the land. It's the fact that he lied about it. That he lied about what he got for that piece of land. And right away, God has to nip this in the bud, because he can't allow the church to be a body like Abraham's family was. And so God took Ananias' life. Then he took Sapphira's life when she confirmed the lie. And everybody lived in fear at that point, and they realized God has an agenda here that the gates of hell cannot knock down, cannot overcome. And one thing that it has to be, in order for this to be accomplished, is that there cannot be a lying spirit within the body of Messiah. And that's why this was so harsh. Because if in the body of Messiah you just have a bunch of liars, the body of Messiah is not going to go anywhere. Now, Numbers 32:33. Is that the wrong verse? Did I write the wrong verse? 32:23, I'm sorry. Here's a warning from God. When somebody lies, the rationalization they have to have inside of them is, I got away with it. No one saw me do it. That's our first, we rationalize within ourselves. And who was hurt by it? We're good rationalizers. But listen, look what it says in Numbers. But if you do not, this is God speaking to Israel. But if you do not, behold, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. And we as believers have probably had experiences in our lives, I know that I have, where we've done something that was wrong, and then we lied about it. How? One way to lie about it is not to confess it to God. That's a lie. You're walking with God and you have this lie you didn't tell him about. You're living a lie. And you're also lying before your brothers and sisters. So, having said that, and we're nearing the end of the story of Abraham's family, you know, I guess every family has its own difficulties and challenges. But this is who, through whom God determined to have the royal line of Messiah come. Listen to this, ready? We start with Abraham and Sarah lying to a king. We move to Isaac, who lies to a king. We move to Jacob and Rebekah, who lie to Isaac. You remember she made him smell and dress and so forth like Esau, so he had the blessing. So here a mother and her child are lying to the father. Then we have Jacob and Esau, Jacob lying to Esau. Even after they were reconciled. Because remember when they were reconciled and Esau wanted them to travel together. And Jacob didn't want to travel with Esau. He could have been honest about it, but what he said instead, remember, the children move slowly and the animals are small. You go ahead of me and I'll meet you there. And what does he do? He turns around and goes the other way. Then there's the story of the Gibeonites. If you remember, when Joshua went into the land, all of the nations that dwelt in that land were to be completely destroyed. And remember how the Gibeonites took, I think, two of their men and put them in old clothes that looked very worn, almost no food or water in their sacks. And these men said, "We come from a far country. We'd like to live in peace here." And at first, Joshua was very suspicious. And the elders were suspicious. But in the end, they said, okay, we were not to, God didn't tell us to destroy nations outside of the land. This looks like a peaceable people. And they made a covenant with them. And that covenant allowed them to live in the land and have no fear of Israel. Sure enough, what did they find out? They found out that they had made a vow based on a lie. And although the Gibeonites were wrong in what they did, the vow that Israel made was so important in God's sight that God's said, and this doesn't record it in Scripture, but God, they knew that God expected them to fill their vow. You know, if somebody came to me and said, I'm going to build an apartment complex, and let's say I was a rich guy, and they said, this is how much money I need, and I got somebody who's going to loan me half of it, will you loan me the other half? And I say, yes. And I give him the money, or I don't give it to him yet. The other person backs out. Can I go to this person who wanted to build the apartment complex? Well, I'm only going to give you half of this now, and you can't build it for half, so I'm not going to make it available to you anymore. I can't do that. What I have to say to him is, I'll wait, and I'll put aside the money that I promised you, and once you're in a position to build this apartment complex, I told you I would loan you the money, I will loan you the money. I have to keep my vow. We don't just throw our money away. If it seems like he just can't build the apartment complex, we don't just throw the money away. That's obviously going to be lost. But by the same token, we don't get to pick and choose where we're going. You know, this is not like Monopoly, who has the most money at the end, and it's phony money anyway. Okay. So then, the Gibeonites lie to Israel, and Israel also lied to the Gibeonites. It's very risky. In Genesis 9, no, is that Joshua 9? You see what happens here. It's Joshua 9. In Joshua 9, let's see where we are. And verses 9 verses 16 to 20. This our bread was warm, and we took it for our provisions out of our houses on the day that we left to come to you. But now, behold, it is dry and has become crumbled. So these are telling the Jewish people a lie, these people. They made it look like they had traveled from a far country, but they really hadn't. No, 9 and let's go back to, let's start at verse 9. 9 verse 9 will be good. In fact, 6 will be better. No, 3. Might as well get the story. When the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they also acted craftily and sent out envoys and took worn-out sacks on their donkeys and wineskins worn out and torn and mended, and worn-out and patched sandals on their feet and worn-out clothes on themselves, and all the bread of their provision was dry and had become crumbled. So you see the plot here. They want to convince Israel that they're not one of the nations of this particular land, because they're destroying all those nations and overtaking the land. Then they went to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal and said to him and to the men of Israel, "We have come from a far country. Now therefore make a covenant with us." And here's where it gets risky. The men of Israel said to the Hivites, "Perhaps you are living within our land, then how shall we make a covenant with you?" But they said to Joshua, "We are your servants." Then Joshua said to them, "Who are you and where do you come from?" They said to him, "Your servants have come from a very far country because of the fame of the Lord your God, for we have heard the report of him and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan, who was at Ashtaroth. So our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, saying, 'Take provisions in your hand for the journey, and go meet them, and say to them, "We are your servants, and now make a covenant with us."'" So they're lying to the Jewish people. To Joshua. And then it says, "These wineskins which we filled were new," in verse 13, "and behold, they are torn, and these are clothes, and our sandals are worn out because of the very long journey." So the men of Israel took some of their provisions and did not ask for the counsel of the Lord. I guess that was the big mistake. They relied on their own wisdom. Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live, and the leaders of the congregation swore an oath to them. There you go. You can't get out of it now, even though they were liars. It came about at the end of 3 days after they had made a covenant with them that they heard they were neighbors and that they were living within their land. So they knew now that they had been lied to. Then the sons of Israel sent out and came to the cities on the third day. Now their cities were Gibeon and Heseroth, and Beeroth and Kiriath-Jearim. The sons of Israel did not strike them because of the leaders of the congregation had sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel, and all the whole congregation grumbled against the leaders. They were upset. But all the leaders said to the whole congregation, "We have sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel, and now we cannot touch them. Don't swear by the altar. Don't swear." You know, every people say, "I swear to God." That's such a horrible thing. First of all, it denigrates God. And it's dangerous, because if you make a vow by God and you don't keep it, you're held accountable. And I certainly don't want to be in that position. And so they could not destroy or hurt the Gibeonites. In Hebrews 4:13, it says, you don't have to turn, it's just one short verse. All things are naked and open to him with whom we have to do. And so, if I would sit down right now and have in front of me a list of all the sins I've ever committed, and somebody said to me, next to each sin is a little box. If you committed that sin, fill in the little box. No. If you, that was a sin you committed. If you got away with that sin, fill in the little box. If you didn't, leave the little box empty. And I went through it, more than likely I'd have a lot of empty boxes. Of course, you get away with a lot in this life. But the fact of the matter is, it's impossible to get away with anything. Every single box that you let made empty when you put your pencil down, Yeshua's going to walk in and pick that pencil up and say, this is a lie right now. You're lying right now, you're lying. You're lying about your lies. So, Roman numeral 2, Israel was not to intermarry with them or make treaties with the Canaanites. This passage also warns against going to visit the daughters of the land. Remember, God wanted to protect the line of the covenant. So he didn't want them, he didn't even want them to have anything to do with the people who lived in that land, let alone Abraham got involved, as we'll read, in some financial pursuits with them, some business dealings, which was foolish. And they were also not to make any treaties with them. So there they made a mistake because they didn't go to God for counsel with these Gibeonites. And God gave that warning, don't make any covenants with them for a good reason. And also the passage warns, chapter 34 warns, about going to visit the daughters of the land, because that could lead to the assimilation of the Jewish people. Okay? Three. Moreover, covenantal agreements must not be made in a sham. In other words, as wrong as it is to enter a vow and not keep it, it's equally as bad to enter a vow that's a deceitful vow. Not playing chess here. Who can get away with what? And what can I do with my sly tongue? If you make a vow, don't make a vow. He's saying don't even make the vow. Just say, I will do this, and do it. For this, Simeon and Levi were passed over in the blessing with the birthright. When we get to chapter 49 and we see the blessings, we see that they were looked over because of their involvement here. Okay, now here's what happens in this passage. Let's read chapters 1 to 4 first. Genesis 34, 1 to 4. Let's wait until the end of the first break to do this, because we're right at the halfway point now, and then we can do the notes in your notebook for the second half. So Dinah went out to visit the daughters of the land, and again, the question right off the bat is, we know this was dangerous, we know it could lead to assimilation. Dinah should not have done that, but where were her brothers and her father when all this was going on? Were they so taken up with their business pursuits they forgot they had a young woman, you know, in their family? When Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he took her and lay with her by force. He was deeply attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this young girl for a wife." New type of courtship. Okay, in the notes now, the defilement of Dinah. Dinah, Jacob's only daughter, went out to visit the daughters of the land. This loosened a stone that caused a landslide of difficulty for Jacob. Jacob had made, you know, I was in the Boy Scouts, we used to do things like climb up the side of, not really a mountain, but like a hill. And sometimes you'd reach up, and before you could hold on to a rock and have it support your weight, you had to feel it, see if it was in, you know, solid before you put all your weight on it. And every once in a while, you made the judgment call, this is a good rock for me to go up to the next level. And so you put your weight on it, and all of a sudden, there's like a thunderstorm of rocks come flying down on you. You got to be very careful when you do that. And that's a good analogy for what happened here, because this only created tremendous difficulty for everybody. Jacob's reaction, five. Shechem, the ruler of that area, lay with her and violated or raped her. No, not in the right place. Jacob had made a commercial connection with Shechem, which he should not have done. But Dinah's step towards social interaction had serious complications. Avoidance of the Canaanites would have been much safer. Nothing to gain and everything to lose. Shechem, the ruler of that area, lay with her and violated or raped her. After a woman was debased in this way, she had no expectancy of ever having a valid marriage. She became like a social outcast. However, Shechem loved Dinah and wanted her to be his wife. Now, a lot of people, I think most people don't really appreciate what, there's a show on called Law and Order, Special Victims Unit, and that's the division of a New York police area where they have this squad that deals only with rape and child molesting and all that stuff. And it's pretty realistic what they do without getting all too much gory and stuff like that. But unless you in some way have experienced it, either have had something like this happen to yourself or had somebody very close to you have it happen in their life, I have a friend whom I've known since college. He fell in love with a girl and he got married and had a very good marriage. One night, while they were sleeping, four guys broke into the house, came into their bedroom and pointed guns at them. And I don't even want to describe what happened next because it's too defiling. I don't think the Lord would be pleased if I did. She was never the same again. Her countenance changed permanently. And she was such a wonderful, wonderful believer. But even to a believer, you know, I always feel for them because they're a very good couple. They're beautiful Christians. These things happen. Why does God let them happen? We don't know. But she was so vivacious and bubbly and friendly and happy person. And from that time on, she's just been deteriorating because, you know, I know what women go through. It was my fault. You know, all kinds of horrible, horrible things. I personally think, this is my own personal opinion, that rape should be a capital offense. That's it. Because you're stealing someone's life from them. What kind of life can a person have after something like this? Certainly a child. You rob them of their childhood and alter their life. I don't think that we should, you know, we want to give the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they can be rehabilitated. No, 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 no. Look what they did. Look at what happened to the person they did, and have a little feeling for them. Okay, now. Such a sexual evil was infamous, incriminating a whole community. It was something that should not be done. While the sons were filled with grief and fury, Jacob was passive and could not pull things together. Jacob heard about this first while his sons were out at work, and he didn't do anything at all. And it's a little bit of a mystery why. It may be that he was older now and he was willingly now ready to pass the mantle on to his sons. We're not sure. Perhaps if Dinah were his daughter by Rachel rather than Leah, he would have acted differently. I don't believe that. I just want to give you one of the possibilities that some commentators say that Jacob would have reacted differently had he been a daughter of Rachel, his favorite wife. I don't really go for that. He was a father. Then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. Now the sons of Jacob came in from the field, and when they heard it, the men were grieved, and they were very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing ought not to be done. Okay, now. The next thing that's going to happen is the Canaanites are going to come with a proposal. Verses 8 through 12. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage. Intermarry with us, give your daughters to us, and take our daughters for yourselves." You can almost hear Satan's voice in that, you know? Here's another time he's trying to defile the line of the seed. "Thus you shall live with us, and the land shall be open to you." They did own the land. They said, "We'll open the land to you for agriculture and livestock. Live in it and trade in it and acquire property in it." Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers, "If I find favor in your sight, then I will give whatever you wish to me." So he's trying to buy her now. "Ask me ever so much bridal payment and gift, and I will give it to you according as you say to me, but give me the girl in marriage." But Jacob's sons answered Shechem and his father Hamor with deceit, because he had defiled Dinah, their sister. They said to him, "We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this one condition will we consent to you. If you will become like us, in that every male of you shall be circumcised, then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters for ourselves, and we will live with you and become one people. But if not, if you will not listen to us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and go." Now, this was a sham offer of a covenant. They had no intentions of doing this from the word go. You've read it. You know what they're planning here. But let's go to the notes. Okay, the Canaanites, top of page 131 here. The Canaanites approached with a proposal. Old Hamor, Shechem's father, made a diplomatic speech. He asserted that great advantages would be gained by both from an agreement to intermarry. He offered Israel the land. But God, not the Canaanites, would give Israel the land. He promised to Abraham, promised it to Isaac, promised it to Jacob. Furthermore, Hamor's later appeal to his favorite fellow citizens showed that he was deceptive all along, hoping to take over Joseph's possession. When he goes to his own people, just listen quickly what it says in verse 23, when he's trying to convince his own people to do this, it's worth getting circumcised. Watch what he says. "Will not their livestock and their property and all their animals be ours? Only let us consent to them and they will live with us." So everybody's lying to everybody now. You know, neither party is telling the truth. The sons of Jacob have no intention of intermarriage. And even if these people would get circumcised, they wouldn't hold up their end of the bargain to get circumcised. We'll see what they're going to do. But in the same time, Shechem and Hamor are not being honest to the Jewish people, to Israel, because when they go back to their own people to argue in favor of this covenant, they say, we'll get everything they own. It'll all become ours. So lies are flying all over the Middle East right now, as they are today. Okay. Old Hamor, Shechem's father, made a diplomatic speech. He asserted that great advantages would be gained from both an agreement to intermarry. He offered Israel the land. But God, not the Canaanites, would give Israel the land. Furthermore, Hamor's later appeal to his fellow citizens showed that he was deceptive all along, hoping to take over Jacob's possessions. Shechem then offered to pay Jacob and Dinah's brothers whatever price for the bride they suggested, trying to buy his way out of trouble. There's people who believe they can do that, and they do it all the time, and then the time comes when they can't do it, and they have a nervous breakdown. They're so used to getting their way and being able to buy their way out of trouble that when the day comes that they're in a situation they can't buy their way out of trouble, they break down. They've never been held accountable. Okay, the brothers' reaction. A, the brothers refused such a treaty because they said Shechem was not circumcised and intermarriage would be a disgrace. So the brothers planned for Shechem's outward conforming to circumcision, but of course this was not true covenant. The brothers, like their father, dealt deceitfully. They apparently assumed that Shechem and Hamor would never consent to their males being circumcised as a condition for intermarriage. What they were anticipating was that Hamor, his father, Shechem and his father and the people of that city would never agree to being circumcised, and that in that way they would get a refusal and they would get Dinah back. But they never intended to enter into a covenant with these people under any circumstances. Because watch. But the Canaanites accepted the proposal and have had every man in the town circumcised. Not only so Shechem could have Dinah, but also so they could subtly acquire all the Israelites' livestock and other property. That was their deceit. Okay, verses 25 through 31, the treachery of Jacob's sons. So we can go down to 25. Actually, we should start at 18. Yeah. Well, the notes will pick up at 25 to 31. Okay. Now their words seemed reasonable to Hamor and Shechem's Hamor's son. Of course, they had a hidden agenda. They wanted Dinah. The young man did not delay to do the thing because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. Now he was more respected than all the household of his father. So Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of their city and spoke to the men of their city, saying, "These men are friendly with us. Therefore, let them live in the land and trade in it, for behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters in marriage and give our daughters to them. Only on this one condition will the men consent to live with us, to become one people, that every male among us be circumcised as they are circumcised. And here's the kicker. Here's how he convinces them. Will not our livestock and their property all and their animals all be ours? Only let us consent with them, and they will live also with us. Now, he wasn't really caring about anybody but himself. He didn't really have his neighbor's interests at heart. He wanted a woman. Now, it came about on the third day when they were in pain, and I don't remember my circumcision because I was only 8 days old. But it's a good thing you do it when you're 8 days old and not 18 years old. It must be very painful. And especially a wound sometimes gets more painful before less painful. So it came about on the third day when they were in pain that two of Jacob's sons, Simon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came upon the city unawares and killed every male. They killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the edge of the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went forth. Jacob's sons came upon the slain and looted the city because they had defiled her sister. They took their flocks and their herds and their donkeys and that which was in the city and that which was in the field. They captured and looted all their wealth and all their little ones and their wives, even all that was in the houses. Then Jacob said to Simon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and my men being few in number, they will gather together against me and attack me, and I will be destroyed and my household." See, Jacob's concerned, I have to live among all these nations. I don't want to have a reputation for breaking covenants and destroying cities. I don't want to get that kind of relationship because I won't be able to do business with anybody, and who knows what they'll gather together and do to me. But they, the brothers, said, "Should we treat our sister as a harlot?" Okay, going down to the bottom of page 131, the brothers' plot was tragic. Simeon and Levi slaughtered the Canaanite males while they were still in pain from the circumcision and still weak from healing. The brothers then rescued Dinah and plundered the city and the fields for all the Shechemites' property, livestock, wealth, and women and children. They couldn't get anything right. I mean, if they're going to do anything here, they should have put the city under the ban, which God commanded the Jewish people to do to these nations that were living in the promised land. Putting a city under ban means you kill everyone, all the livestock, and you burn it to the ground and you take no spoils. God didn't want them taking spoils from these defiled countries, and he didn't want them taking their women either, because their women were idol worshippers. And look what happened to King Solomon. He married foreign women, and he became an idol worshiper. It ruined his spiritual life. And at the end of his life, you read the book of Ecclesiastes, it seems like he was miserable at the end of his life. But this city? Have they figured out how many were? No, I don't know. The best answer I can give you, though, nations and tribes and cities were much smaller than they are today. For example, I would not by any means think that this city would be as large as, like, L.A. They were smaller back then. What they called a nation, we might call a tribe. They were much smaller. It's not like these two men went and slaughtered 3 million men. It's hundreds, a couple hundred. Okay. The brothers then rescued Dinah and plundered the city and the fields for all the Shechemites' property, livestock, wealth, women, and children. This all struck fear in the heart of Jacob, for it could bring about serious repercussions on him and his family, because he had to live among all these other nations in the area, and he was fear what his position in trading would be. Would he be mistrusted from then on? Would they form alliances against him? But the brother simply replied, "Should Shechem have treated our sister like a prostitute?" I'm really on the side of the brothers, but not the way they did it. I'm on the side of the brothers, but I don't think they did it as they should have. They could have handled it, same result, different method. Moreover, in this story, the instinct of Simon and Levi was correct, because of the unbridled passion, they were later passed over in Jacob's blessing in Genesis 49. Moreover, a deceptive covenant was not to be dangled before pagans. On occasion, however, God does use a Simon or a Levi or a Jehu as his instruments of judgment. God used Israel as an instrument of judgment of all these wicked nations in Canaan. And so, sometimes people will say to me, how can you say the Old Testament isn't divinely inspired when God has people running around killing people all over the place? The answer is God would be perfectly just and righteous if he just wiped the human race out. He would be righteous if he sent me or you to our eternal resting place, depending on the way we lived our lives. Let's be honest about it. We're both liars. I know you've lied. You know I've lied in our lifetime. And who knows what other sins. So God wiped out the entire human race except for 8 people with a flood. It's his earth. And they deserve to get what they got. And if God chooses to use an army to judge a group of people who are defiling the land and putting their children on fire as sacrifices and having homosexual relationships, God owns this universe. It's his, it's not ours. And when we defile his creation, who are we to tell God how he can and cannot manage his creation? When God was speaking to Abraham about the nations that were living in that land, he said, the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. So it just wasn't time yet for them to be judged. They were judged when Joshua came in. That's called the forbearance of God. He's extraordinarily patient with us. He gave them a lot of time, and they didn't respond. And when God is slow to punish, but when he does, as it says in the Bible, it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God.
And I never read it because I never realized it like that. So he did, because I had people say, well, why did he allow them to kill all those people? Well, because it was that time, because their sin was so corrupt and so corrupt.
That's true. I mean, we justify what we did in Iraq. I'm talking about under George Bush #1. We justify what we did in Iraq under George Bush #1 because if we hadn't stepped in and done something, the whole balance of power in the Mideast may have shifted, much to our advantage, disadvantage, and Israel's disadvantage. Now, you know, it's interesting. When one country is fighting against another country, what can sometimes happen is the armies of the one country succeed so well in the war that they actually are able to invade the other country. Like during World War II, Hitler marched right under the Arc de Triomphe. He had overcome the French. And that's one of the saddest days in France's history. But of course, ultimately he lost the war. And so, to a certain extent, we have to say, there is justice, sometimes it's deferred, but no one, it says that every mouth will be closed and every knee bowed. At the white throne judgment, when all the non-believers who have ever lived stand before the Lamb to be judged, none of them will offer a complaint or an argument or a rationalization. The time for that is long past. Because as it says, the Yeshua said, the things done in secret will be shouted from the rooftops. And you're not going to be able to stand in front of God and rationalize your sin away with Him. You know, people who, I remember, who was that guy, the astronomer who had the astronomy shows all the time, passed away not long ago? I can't remember his name. There's a fella, he used to be on the educational channels, and he was a very well-known astronomer, and he used to do a one-hour show once a week on the universe, but on the layman's level. And he was a devout atheist. And he came down with cancer. And he had a lot of people trying to convince him, you're going to die, you need God in your life. And on his deathbed, he was surrounded by scientists who were believers. They came and visited him. And when he would end, I wish I could remember his name, maybe Bob knows it, at the end of each show, you know what he used to say? The universe, all there's ever been, all there is, and all there will ever be. That's what he said at the end. And I used to watch it before I was saved, and I didn't know what he was getting at when he said that. It just sounded like profound. But it's a very atheistic statement. But lying on his deathbed, they were saying to him, you don't know how much time you have left. Let us read some scriptures to you. You've got to consider these things. And he wouldn't, and he died. Now, the interesting thing is, so therefore we can conclude he didn't get saved. Well, we can't, because we don't know what God can communicate to somebody. He can turn a 1 minute of conversation with that person into 1,000 years worth. So we can never do that. However, if we were to assume that this man did die unsaved, he was probably pretty disappointed 1 second after he died. He had every chance in the world. All he had to do is confess his sins and accept Jesus as a Savior, and he refused to do it. Human pride. Atheism is, I believe atheism is a form of mental illness. I do. And it shows that there were some problems somewhere in the family. My apologetics teacher went into that in detail, and I can't remember all the details, but atheism results from something early in your life. And I can't remember the details he went into, but it's really a disease. It's a sickness of the spirit. Because we were made to fellowship with God. And even those who worship false gods, that's an abomination. Make no mistake about it. But at least they believe that there's something greater than we are, that there's gods. Now, I'm not justifying by any means idol worship. It's a complete abomination and can be the downfall of a country. But atheism is even worse. I mean, the atheist turns his or her whole back on the concept of God and says, only me. I want nothing to do with God at all. Try, maybe Bob remembers the name of that guy. He's very good. The show was very interesting. I always liked it. So, any questions, comments? And we'll start next time. We'll do chapter 35. What we're getting, right now we're averaging, I think, a chapter a week now. Give us an idea of, you know, when we'll be through.